This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you, Parker. And hey, hey, everyone, I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. What happens when you take the musical legacy of Memphis and mix it with a combination of smoke and funk, a dash of country, a pinch of gospel, and blend all of that together with roots and soul just for good measure? Well, you have a completely new musical genre, and today's guest and her band lovingly refer to this as Memfunk. And I'm telling you, this is the real deal, man. This band released its first album, Alive, in 2020, and spent an astounding 22 straight months, not weeks, months, on the top of the top 50 blues rock album chart, with all 11 songs hitting the top 50 with multiple month runs, and finishing the year at number 10 of the 2020 top 200 year-end chart. That's pretty damned impressive, if you ask me. Now, you talk about a breathless run, but after checking their music, I can see why. It's got the groove, it's got a strong beat, and I dare you to listen to it and not feel like you want to get up and dance, okay? Memfunk, in my opinion, is here to stay. Oh yeah, and accolades, they've got some of those too. The band took home the Blues Foundation's 2024 Best Self-Produced CD Award at the International Blues Challenge, and they have been nominated for 8 Independent Blues Awards. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to be able to introduce you all to Kimberly Dill, lead vocalist, and her husband, guitarist Jamie Holdren of Sister Lucille. Kim, Jamie, welcome to Time Signatures.
Hello.
Thanks for having us, man.
Yes, we're happy to be here.
Wow, what an honor, guys, truly. I rarely get this excited to talk to someone about their band, but as I told you this afternoon, as I was finalizing this interview and I was listening to your music, all I can say is this stuff got a hold of me, man. It resonates with me.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's our goal, man. We're trying to keep it real, as they say.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're definitely keeping it real. All right. So while I'm taking a moment to gather myself here, please talk about your musical journey. Kim, I'm going to start with you. Where did it begin for you?
Oh, gosh. As a little girl, my family was in a band together, both sides of my family. That's how my mom and dad met. My grandfathers got together and created a family country band. And my dad and my mom were the lead singer and the guitar player, just like me and Jamie. And so they got together, and that's where I came from. So I've been singing, my mom says, since I came out, basically. Okay. 2 years old, I knew every Crystal Gayle song by word, you know, every word. And it was just my thing. She says I was just born to do it. And I believe her, coming from that family. He did too. He has family, musicians on both sides.
Jamie, talk about your start, man. Where did it begin for you?
You know, a bit of a similar story. I come from a musical family with blessed to be around music from my first memories, basically. You know, my dad was a guitar player. My great uncle had a full family band and had a show called the Kimberling City Opry down at in Branson, Missouri, Kimberling City.
Wow.
And so, yeah, my first time on stage was 6 years old. And I've had a guitar in my hand ever since. And just once again, just blessed to be born into that family and that life. And I wouldn't have known anything any different.
Yeah.
I thought everybody's family was like that.
Like, people ask me, you know, how do you get up there and not be scared and not be nervous? And I'm like, because I wasn't never taught that I was supposed to be. You know, it was just what I did. You know,
that's fair.
I didn't know I was so supposed to be scared. My mom wasn't like, oh, now don't you go out there and get on. She was like, you're going to go out there and you're going to sing your little butt off, you know, and bam, there I go. I was like, when I first got like 500 people, when I was like six, I sang in front of like 500 people at this MBA benefit.
Wow.
And funny story is that night I sang with the band and the bass player, I walk on stage and he's like, "What are you going to sing?" And I'm like, "Blue Kentucky Girl." And he's like, "What key?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And he's like, "Sing it to me." So I sang him a line and he's like, "Key of G, boys." And they take off and I'm like, "Sing the song." And the whole crowd goes nuts. And in that moment, I remember, I was like, "I want to do this." I just knew in that moment. And that bass player 20 years later became my stepfather, who helped me create Sister Lucille. So that's kind of a cool that he was the first one that I played with as a little girl. And then later
wow.
became my bass man in Sister Lucille. But in between there, I got very fortunate and had a lot of things going on for me in Nashville when I was a teenager. And when I was like 19, I got to sing at the Grand Ole Opry on the
Wow,
Ryman
that's
stage.
An honor.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest thing I've done in my life.
Yes, ma'am.
You know,
yes,
the biggest
ma'am.
Honor I've had. And then I got to come back and I opened up for Kitty Wells that day. And then I got to go back and open up for Jack Green at the new Grand Ole Opry. So I've sang on both stages. And then we got to go
How
back to
cool
the
is
Josie
that?
Awards a couple years ago. We had Song of the Year and Video of the Year up. And I got to go back and hang out where I'd sang. It was really cool. I hadn't been there since. So that's kind of like my journey. I started out in country.
Yeah. Well, and I can imagine, you know, coming up in country, there is no bigger honor in country than to be on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, to stand
For
in that
sure.
circle where, because, you know, they've still got a piece of the old stage too in the new
Yes.
Grand Ole Opry. So I actually got to stand on that stage and sing, you know, the Ryman. And then they took a piece of it and put it in the old ones, or the new one from the old one. So,
right. I was
just getting able to stand in that circle, as they say. I got to stand in the circle.
I was there in 79, and that was back when Minnie Pearl and Grandpa Jones were still there. I think Skeeter Davis sang that night, Roy
That would have been
Acuff,
awesome.
and that was a big deal. I get goosebumps thinking about it. So at what point, I mean, it sounds like for you, it was like right away, Kim, but at what point did the two of you decide that the life of a musician was in the cards for you?
Like I said, it was my dream my whole life. It's what I wanted to be. You know, I went to college, but I wanted to be a singer. And I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to get to do it. I did some videos, some movies. I got to record in Nashville and got to do all those amazing things. So my career was really starting then. And he was playing heavy metal at the time, which I think brings kind of a new essence to our music. You know, it's like this conglomeration of, like you said in the introduction, it's like this melting pot of all these pieces, you know, of
it was
music and our
1993,
influence.
You know, I mean, Metallica was huge.
They still are. Come on.
We actually kind of took a hiatus because we have a son and we had him. So we kind of couldn't go out on the road and tour. So we just kind of played locally for a while. And then we had him so young that it was like we were 35 and he's graduating pretty much. So that's when we started the Sister Lucille journey because we wanted to play with my stepdad. We had never played together, the guy I was just talking about earlier. So that's how we initially even thought of doing a blues band. Because
I'm gonna stop you because I wanna come back to that and hit that a lot more heavy.
Sure.
Jamie, let me talk to you, man. At what point did you realize that it was in the cards for you?
For me, I mean, if you want to say, you know, life-changing experience, when I really realized that this is what I wanted to do for sure was, I went to visit my mom in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It would have been 1986. And, you know, I'd, you know, been to local festivals, you know, around here, mostly bluegrass music and country music, which is, you know, what my life had been up until that point. I believe I was 10 years old that summer. And my mom took me to Tingley Coliseum in Albuquerque, New Mexico to see Bachman Turner Overdrive and Van Halen.
Oh, nice, nice.
And, you know, I had never seen anything like that before, you know, being around music most of my life was obviously much smaller venues and much smaller crowds.
Live within a net, huh?
And yeah, so I mean,
the craziest tour you could ever see as a
see
kid.
That at 10 years old had a huge major influence on me. Obviously, looked like the rock and roll guys were having more fun than
the country
guys. So that's really, you know, the moment that I said, hey, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Absolutely. Now I want to get the genesis of this band going here, and I'm going to walk through a couple of things, so please bear with me. I'd love to know where the name Sister Lucille came from.
Well, many nights on Beale Street.
Okay.
We used to go to Beale when we were off the road. We'd play like Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We would drive to Memphis on Sunday night to hang out with our favorite band, Free World. And it was just like our escape from the work from the week, you know, we got to be free. So we spent a lot of time there. And we were hanging out there before anyone even knew on Beale Street that we were in a band. We never really told anybody. We just went and hung out with people
why
and learned,
we?
You know.
Why
everyone says that, oh, I'm in a band too.
Memphis,
so we're just not that people, you know.
As soon as I got to Memphis, the level that people were playing and the realness of what everyone was doing was just on a level I had really never seen before. And I've been to a lot of places and around a lot of music scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And Kansas City, you know, is maybe something that I could, you know, compare. But I mean, Memphis was a recording capital of the world at one point in time, and it's the birthplace of the blues.
I get goosebumps just thinking about it.
Rock and roll. I mean, jazz even is just, you know.
Yeah.
And so the level that everyone was playing at down there, you know, not
we were
just
going to school,
not just guitar players, but bass players, drummers. I mean, everybody's just on this astronomical
the
level.
Singers are like blowing you out of the water and you're like, oh my God, I'm not even gonna go home and sing again. You know, that's how you feel. But no, then you go sing, you know, so people didn't even know we were in a band. And starting the name, we were sitting in BB's, me and Jamie, and I look up there and see the neon sign that says Lucille, and we're just starting the band. We don't even have a name for it. We're just like, we're going to start playing with Dad. I really want Dad to be in a band with us. So why don't we just start playing some covers and having some fun and do this once a month or something with Dad? That was the whole goal.
Okay.
So we're sitting there and I see that neon sign and it was just like, Lucille, BB, he's my favorite singer and guitar player. Why not name the band after his beautiful guitar, which represents my music because of Jamie, you know? So we are a guitar, written band. So it just made sense. And then I was like, why not put, because I was thinking in my head, there's brother this, there's brother Kane, there's all these other different things.
Sure.
And it just came to me, Sister Lucille. And it stuck. Everyone was like, that sounds perfect, I think. So we kind of went with it.
Well, I immediately brought up the reference back to Statesboro
Blues. We have a double.
You know, and Statesboro Blues. You said,
totally.
You know, if the sister,
you don't want to, Sister Lucille says she would.
And there's actually more references if you really dig deep into old blues. Sister Lucille's referenced in several songs. You know, I can't think of the exact ones. Obviously, Statesboro Blues being the most famous one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Sister Lucille. You know,
I didn't even think of that.
Kind of, you know, represents that girl that was going to be hanging out in the juke joint partying with the band. You know,
okay. Let's reference back to why BB's guitar was named Lucille, because a girl started a brawl in the middle of a club in Jump, Arkansas, and knocked over the kerosene heater and started a fire, and everyone ran out. BB ran back in and got his guitar off the stage. And from that moment on, he named her Lucille after the woman that started the fire in the brawl.
Yep. Now you mentioned, Kim, that the reason for starting this band was so that you could get your father, your stepfather involved, correct?
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit, would you?
Sure. You know, we were actually, like I said, just trying to get some local gigs. We were like, why don't we just play once or twice a month here locally? And they were having the IBC challenge. for our local blues society.
Okay.
And we were like, well, we want to play at that club. I said, so this will be a good chance for us just to go in there, and it's like a tryout. We weren't even thinking about winning or even cared about that. We just wanted to play in front of the, the guy at the venue.
Yeah, I knew the promoter and the guy that booked acts at the club at that point in time was called Cartoons. Be there that day, so you know, no expectation.
Yeah, we're like, okay, let's throw some songs.
Doing
together.
Anything except for getting ourselves in front of him, so that maybe we could get a future gig there. You know. That was what the intention was for entering. No aspirations or really even considered, you know, winning.
And we go and we win and we're looking at each other and we're like, boys, we're going to Memphis. I guess we got to take this serious.
How kind cool of is that?
What you wish for? What are we going to do now?
Yeah.
We had to make an album fast. We had to do all this stuff. And that's how Walking Shoes came about. That was our first record. That's why it's a bootleg, because we basically did it quick so we could have it ready to go to the IBC challenge with us.
Yeah, recorded it local.
Yeah, we recorded it local. So yeah, and then we did great down there, and that's where our name started. And then we went back again. We won in Arkansas locally, and then went back again. Like, what was it, 3 years after the first time?
Wow,
something like that. And we made semifinals, and it was like,
how cool.
Yeah, I'm gonna say it was like 2013 when we first went, and this is like 2015 or 16.
Okay.
And my dad, when we were there, he was like, look, honey, you're getting ready to soar. You're getting ready to go do things. I need to be at home on the farm. So he retired right there in Memphis after we won semifinals.
No kidding.
Yeah. So we had to get another baseman, but I'm so thankful that he did that, because he passed from cancer in 2019. And if he wouldn't have taken that time away from us, he wouldn't have got to spend it with the little grandkids that he had. So I'm so thankful that he did do that. It was like meant to be, but he passed right before Alive was finished or released.
We're going to revisit that in just a minute. I wanted to ask you though, because this new genre of music that y'all have formulated is, I'm sold, man. I'm absolutely sold. It's called Mem Funk. Okay. I understand how you put it together. I've heard it. It's infectious. This just might be the single biggest development within the blues genre in my recent memory.
Wow.
Talk to me about how you brought this together, because there had to be some thought that went into this.
Into the new record?
You know, like I said earlier, you know, it's keeping it real. So we come originally from country music backgrounds, you know.
Sure.
That's how I write, basically, unfortunately.
But both of us being, you know, born in 75 and growing up in the 80s, obviously we're exposed to a lot of rock and roll and a lot of great rock and roll bands.
Yeah, you were.
And you know, even me, you know, ultimately playing, you know, heavy metal for a few years. So you have all these different influences musically. I mean, if you get on my playlist on Apple Music, I mean, it's just all over the place. You know, I love just all different kinds of music, all different styles.
And I get it.
So my thing is that I don't want to just copy blues. I don't want to just copy. I want to take everything that we have, all the tools in the toolbox, and just build a car out of all these different parts, kind of like Johnny Cash did.
Yeah.
One piece at a time, baby. Yeah.
And so it was literally about, you know, not trying to follow something that had already been done, but more so trying to create our own thing, which was, though, heavily influenced by what we were learning in Memphis at the time.
It all has to do with Memphis. That's why Mem Funk was even, you know, that's why we even came up with that, because seriously, for a year, we went there and learned and didn't tell anybody that we were musicians. Mm. We were just observing, listening to songs, learning. I learned so much. And then we're like, we're going to do it. You know, so Memphis is everything for this band. And that's why I want everything that I ever record and do to be in Memphis, because that's my heart. That's the heart of the band. So we decided to go full force with the woman team on this last record, which I'm very proud of. We have woman engineer, woman producer, Reba Russell. She's the queen of Memphis and the queen of saying what she thinks and what she feels, and she don't care. And that is, she's my idol. So for her to get to produce it, sing with me on the record, the duet on there was written by her. She's never recorded with anybody else except her hero ever. So I got that opportunity to be on a record with her too.
Yeah, a lot of what we're talking about, what, you know, this 12, 13 year journey that we've taken really started out as us just being fans of everything that was happening in Memphis. We were huge fans of Reba Russell and getting to see her live and in Memphis in an intimate setting.
No idea that you could just go into a random bar and I'm going to see my favorite singer on the planet. I'm going to be like Janis Joplin being in the, I mean, that's how much I loved her. So, you know, getting to just experience that and get to be friends with her and create that relationship with like your idol.
Well, at that point in time, when we were just going as fans and just going to see her play, we would never dream that we would be one day co-writing and being produced by
the queen.
And that was something that if someone would have told me that back then, I would have laughed. I'm just saying, just because, I mean, you know, once again, we were still, we'd played all of our lives and we were at a certain level for our local, you know, Memphis was just this whole other thing. And this level that was so elevated that I didn't even think that it was obtainable, you know, for me to be able to even fit in down there. And it did take years, you know, of really studying hard and really developing my own style and, you know, slowing down.
We got found out. So literally we started the band, put it on Facebook or whatever. And we walk into BB's and everyone knows us down there. We walk in, the people on the stage are like, it's Kim and Jamie, you know, and they're like, you know, Kim and Jamie in the house, you know, they always call our name out. And so we're like family. And he walks That's off cool. stage and he's like, so what's this Sister Lucille shit I'm seeing on Facebook? And we said, oh, guess you caught us. He was I've known you for a year now and you haven't told me that you're a singer. He said, are you going to get up here and sing with me today? And I was like, no, I've been partying all night. It's 11 o'clock. Jamie elbows me and says, you better get your ass up there. And I said, I'll go if he can go. So we go up there. Leroy Hodges, the king of freaking Royal Studios, every Al Green record you've ever heard, O.V. Wright, freaking all of them, is up here playing bass. And I'm like, And I get up there and sing Coco Taylor. And the whole room stands up. And I was like, whoo, I just got lucky in BB's.
It's like Albert Collins.
That was her opportunity to get to take the stage with the legend. I mean, anything Ann Peebles, anything.
And he absolutely loves me now. And we're great friends. And we were even talking about doing a tribute to him because he's still around. He's like 82, 83 years old and still playing bass every week on Bill Street.
That's funny. That story reminds me of Albert Collins from Adventures in Babysitting, where he says, nobody gets out of here without singing the blues.
But I forgot about that.
Let's use this as a springboard because I want to talk about your albums for a moment, one at a time.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned that your debut album, Alive, came out shortly after your stepfather passed from cancer.
Yes.
But you said that he got to hear the tracks prior to that. That must have been some listening session, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually, he was in the studio, so we did it in two rounds. So we did a round in November, and he found out at the end of that month that he had cancer, and he passed away in April. So he got to hear the first round. He was in the studio when we recorded the first round, at least. He got to experience that with us. We didn't know he had cancer at that time, but it was already in his bones and everything. And he was always having back problems. So that's when we knew. He went to the doctor. We found out he had like 6 weeks to live, maybe. They told us two, but he lived for six. So he got to hear all the tracks because it was April and it was released in like October. So he got to hear the whole record before it went to be mastered. So, you know, while he was sick. So
22 months on the top 50 blues album chart with all 11 songs making their mark along the way. Three songs from that album became mainstays on BB King's Bluesville on Sirius XM. That's no easy feat, is it?
No.
No, that was another holy crap moment for me because
on the new artist debut from the Blues Blast magazine that year too. It was amazing.
I was just gonna mention that. Go ahead.
I just thought about it and I looked up there. We were in California on vacation, actually a vacation. And
wow.
We're driving down the road and Reba sends me a message. She's like, guess who just won a Blues Blast award? And I'm like, who? She's like, you. And I go, ah! Jamie's like, what? He almost crashes the car. And I'm like, I'm sorry.
Wow.
I won that award. We were not expecting that. So yes, Alive was amazing. And we never imagined that it would have the success that it did. It was it was just breathtaking for us. And made all my dreams come true.
and having had an opportunity to listen to it a couple times through already, it's what put me on the path to becoming a fan. I mean, honestly, and I'm so happy to know that Mick Colace introduced us and made this possible for us to talk today.
He was head of our Alive record. Endless Blues Records. He was the president of that record company.
Well, Mick was always
our anchor for us.
Mick was always a supporter of us to begin with. And
how cool.
Always really kind to us and supportive. And Mick in the beginning played somewhat of an instrumental role in helping us to understand the business a little more, how to actually release a professional record, how to promote it.
A lot of thanks to him for that record, actually.
Yeah, Mick's a wonderful guy, man. Yep. He's really, really a great guy.
And we had already had the record, recorded, so it's not like he made any money off our record. It was everything he did was out of friendship and love. So,
what is it about our genre that people will do stuff like that just because?
I think it's because the love of the music becomes so deep. You realize once you get bitten by that blues bug. I think you start to realize that this is an American art form, and it's American art form that's barely survived throughout the years. And the main thing, I just think that it becomes like a family. The people that you meet through the blues music, the people that support the blues music, the fans, the musicians, you all kind of become this family. And everybody kind of starts to know each other a little bit, or at least, hey, yeah, I've heard of them.
Social media has helped with that a lot. It's like we're all family even more so now because you're following. I mean, I've made so many relationships like that of people that I look up to as musicians, and I tell them, and now we're best friends. It's amazing because of that. So it's helped a lot there.
And Memphis, once again, I keep referencing Memphis, but Memphis was just so supportive when we did start to get up on stage and start to play.
You're famous there than our hometown.
Everyone was just really supportive and you didn't have that jealousy or like we were in competition with anybody because everybody's so confident there to begin with. I mean, they all came up, once again, recording capital of the world. I mean, it's just in the, you got Mississippi right below the true birthplace of the blues. So, everybody's just, it's like one big family, man. That's all there is to it. And I'm a family oriented guy. I'd love to be a part of a family and family always comes first for me. So it all naturally fit for us.
Yeah.
And it was like it was meant to be.
And Alive was kind of like, we didn't know if we would ever be able to do another big record like this. It was like a dream record. It's kind of how I looked at it. So we never really expected what we got from it. It was like, I was really sick for 2 years before we even started working on that record. I got down to 90 pounds. I mean, I was in bed for 16 hours a day. I was not in a good state at all. So Alive was the first song that I really wrote to tell you the truth. I wrote poetry my whole life. I did that, but I don't play an instrument. So in my mind, you can't be a songwriter if you don't play an instrument. Duh, I'm a lyricist. Now I have 900 songs in my phone, okay? So I just had to convince myself that you can write. Jamie wrote basically all of Walking Shoes, Woman's Point of View. He's writing about himself. I'm like, this is great. So one day he was just like, look, you need to try to write some songs because you need to write from a woman's point of view. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I wrote a live. It came to me in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, before we even really had, you know, a good cell phone. So I got up and sang it into the computer and went back to bed. And if I wouldn't have done that, that song would not be, because I did not remember what I did. So the whole song was written about me coming back to life and realizing all the beautiful things in life and so people's love and the sky and just everything, you know, the things that you take for granted until it's almost gone. You know, it's kind of what I wrote that song about.
And I think that Mem Funk makes a little more sense to me now, because it is such a lively variation of all these genres being mixed together like that. I think that was
one of the points I was trying to get to too, was that our writing, we're not writing blues songs. We're writing whatever happens. If you put a harp in it, it's going to be more blues. You do, you know what I mean? Because I want to write more for the younger people. I'm trying to pull in the younger people into the blues, because they all think it's the old guy sitting on the porch, three chording it, you know.
Well, listen,
they don't understand. So my music is kind of opening up the doors for younger people. That's my goal.
The one thing that caused me to fall in love when we went to Memphis with the blues was that you ultimately have all these subgenres that surround the blues.
That's true.
And it can be country blues. It could be soul blues. It could be rock blues. You know, you really have all these subgenres that surround the blues that are all influenced by the blues. And that was great for me, because it was at a time, once again, we're talking, you know, 13 years ago, where country music, for lack of better words, really started to go down the toilet.
Yeah. It lost its soul.
Because I grew up, you know, with all the old, you know, the outlaw country and most of my main, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash, you know, obviously could go on and on. And then really, you know, rock, just everything mainstream is just all not appealing to me much anymore. And then I stumble across Memphis and I revisit this whole style of music and guitar playing and that is real, that's organic, that's not out here to just sell 100 million copies. It's not going to happen anyway, you know, for anybody except for maybe Joe Bonamassa. And so it's really about this organic, just blending of these different
genre
styles. And hey, you can, you know, and then you have blues purists, you know, that say, you know, if it's not, you know, the old school, then it's not really blues. And
that's,
I get
why
that,
not the contemporary blues category. Yeah. That's what we're in.
I get that. I get where they're coming from, you know, but my answer to those people always be the same thing, and that is, but
we have to keep the blues
that alive. Traditional blues gave way to all these other styles. Yes. and maybe some guy is, you know, just playing really fast riffs and it's blues rock, or maybe it's more R&B based and soul, and maybe it's just a jazz cat and blues gives all these musicians a home. And
which is what Kind of Alive is. You've got funk, you've got country, you've got, I mean, all these different elements, which is just us. I mean, all we're doing is just music.
I'm not going anywhere, man. I found who I am. I found my niche, and I'm a lifer. This is the rest of my life here, man.
I don't know if you guys have had a chance to see Buddy Guy in concert, but Buddy, when we went to see him during his Damn Right Farewell tour, talked about how Muddy charged him before he died with taking the blues and carrying it further down the road.
Yes.
I happen to be one of these people that I consider the blues a buffet. You take a little of this, you take a little of that, you take what you want.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that because you take what you want, that my plate's better than your plate or your plate's exactly. better than mine.
Yeah.
And
sure.
I think a lot of times people get hung up on that, yep. but I want to flip the page and talk about your 2023 album. If I can tell the world, another great piece here at debuted at number 12 on the Billboard Blues charts, won an award with the Blues Foundation for best self-produced CD in 2024 at the IBC. Talk about this album for just a minute, would you please?
You want to start?
I mean, it was a lot of pressure, you know, because we never in a million years expected to have the success we had with Alive. And so now it's like, okay, what do we do now? We're never going to top Alive, you know? And so let's just, once again, let's just start writing what we feel. Let's just start talking about.
I was more confident in my writing for this one because, you know, I'd written Alive and I'd written 100 songs in between there. So I kind of took over some of the lyrics and gave them to him. So I had a little more writing on this one.
Yeah.
But we did a lot together. Reba helped too.
And also, I got a new bass player who was a guy that that I had previously been a fan of in a band called Speakeasy. His name is Reed Smith Heron, and I mean Reed's just a monster bass player, man. You know, and so when we had a bass player position come open, you know, I shot for the moon. Hit the guy up. He doesn't even know who I am, you know, and I'm just like, hey man, you know, I know you don't know me, but I know you, and you know, you would just be such a perfect fit for what I'm trying to do here for what this band is doing. Cause our drummer, Kevin Lyons, and he's been with us from the beginning, you know, Kevin's been with us for about 12 years. I'm so blessed to have Kevin. Kevin mm-hmm. is that old school drummer. He comes from Buffalo, New York, in the jazz scene up there. And Kevin always plays to complement the song. And he's never running a bunch of, even though he can play fancy if he wanted to, but he doesn't want to. He's that solid timekeeper that just always compliments the song. And Kevin is actually, you know, he's several years older than me, let's just say. And Kevin taught me a lot about complimenting the song and about how less is more. Yep. And so, but then when we had an opportunity to get Reed,
we had him finally too. I mean, it just opened up so many things getting Reed.
It was finally, not to take away from the bass player on Alive, because he was a great bass player and you know, and we toured with him for years and he was a great guy. But getting Reed was like, gave me so much confidence and completed the puzzle, because now I had all the tools sharpened,
everything was right where I
wanted it to be. We're going to have this perfect three-part harmony. We're going to have this bass that just really is going to complement everything. And so I kind of, you know, got a shot of confidence and said, hey man, you know, let's do this. Let's do this again. And let's see where it goes. You know, if we fall a little short of Alive, doesn't matter, because we're going to have a blast writing these songs. Yep. We're going to have a blast playing these songs live. And you know, I've got one of the best bassmen in the tri-state area. You know, how can I go wrong?
Right.
So we used him to write a lot of the material. I would sing, like, since I can't play guitar, I'm just making up stuff in my head and singing it in my phone, and I'd play it for him. And bam, he'd have a bass line and we'd write the whole song around that. Or half the time I sing it to him and then he puts the guitar to it. And then, I mean, I don't even know where these songs are going to go because they're in my head.
And he's got some writing credit, you know, because look how this band always worked, but especially with Reed, is, and some of it even started with us just getting together for rehearsal.
Yep.
And I'm just real crazy about, all of a sudden just playing something off the top of my head, because I'm an improvised player.
It pisses me off.
No lessons, talented. You know. I was I never had the attention span to learn songs note for note or to learn solos note for note. And I guess it kind of paid off in the long run, but I used to keep my confidence low because I didn't think, you know, that.
Now I just steal them. I'm like, hey, keep playing that. I'm recording. And he'll be like, well, you got to leave some for me. I said, what are you talking about? You're just going to write another one in 5 minutes. And sure enough, there he goes. And I was like, see, show off.
But anyway,
so a lot of the new songs are coming from that. I steal
but a
music.
few of the songs was literally started by me just playing something right before rehearsal. And Reed would be like, what's that, man? And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm just playing something off the top of my head. And that would turn into to
so I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I got some words over here. And then I'd be like, here we go.
And I mean, it doesn't get much more organic than that. I mean, that's literally writing songs on the fly. It's just a feeling at the time in a moment. And so, you know, going back to Memphis with these songs, we had a little bit of confidence in that, hey, we actually kind of know what we're doing now a little bit.
Reba, so we had Reba as our producer, and I would send her songs and she would help me formulate them and write them, and then we'd give them to the guys. So she was in the writing process too, which was giving me complete confidence, because she'll tell you straight up, no, baby, you need to go work on that one. Or she'll say, absolutely, that's a freaking it, leave it alone. You know, so she tells you exactly what I need to know.
Well, yeah, she gets full producer credits. So, you know, basically I produced the first album, Alive.
She produced the vocals.
She produced the vocals. And she was giving us some little tips here and there. But on Tell the World, you know, she gets full producer credit and I'm co-producer, but... you know, we really bounced most of these songs off of her, let her listen to them first. She gave us tips, gave us pointers.
Wonderful.
Told us what she liked, what she didn't like, which I love.
Yes, that's exactly what you want as a songwriter.
I hate it whenever.
You don't want to waste time.
I hate it whenever that somebody's telling me everything's great all the time, because it can't be.
Right.
I want to hear every now and then.
The last,
I know not all of them's good. No.
In the last place you want to have a yes man is in the recording studio.
Exactly.
I understand.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. For sure.
We had Dawn, which is her. Okay, so the Blue Eyed. What was it? The Blue Eyed Productions? Is that what they call themselves? The Blue Eyed Bitches Productions was who they were. And it's her best friend and her, okay? And they have done every one of Reba's records. So her and Dawn were already Reba's success in history. Well, already in the books.
Dawn's
a
legendary...
she goes on the road with Mavis Staples and does big time
stuff. Engineer,
So she's an engineer.
She's a sound person or recording engineer, also co-producer.
So they both helped us write. She recorded it, engineered it, and so it was a full woman team in the studio for sure, which I'm so elated to have that. And then we got on Blue Heart Records with Tell the World, which was owned by women. The people that promoted us were women. Made the album cover, woman team all the way down, except for my boys. But I was the first one on Blue Heart Record to have a full woman team, and I'm pretty proud of that.
But that's okay. And I mean, listening to the quality of what was produced by that album, I'd be hard pressed to find anything better. I really would.
That's why we won the IBC award.
There you go.
And you know something funny? My producer Dawn was running the sound that day at the theater where I won. So was there when I got my award. She went out to accept it because I was out in the crowd and I had a show that night and they didn't think I was going to be there. So she was going to accept it. And I'm like, I'm here. But that was awesome that she was running the sound for the IBC that day.
Well, and one thing I might back up real quick and say that, you know, on the Alive album, you know, we were having trouble with the mix and I was, you know, using a few people and bouncing off, you know, different mix ideas, and it just wasn't really coming together the way that I wanted it to. And so once again, on a random deal with Reed, I looked up a couple of recording engineers/mixing
technicians,
producers, and of some of the people that I really, you know, look up to and listen
Death
to.
Pete Trucks, Marcus King,
And,
yeah, we
and
went that
this,
big.
this one name kept coming up, which was Jim Scott. And I was like, you know, I sent him an email, you know, and never in a million years
just like
ever thought I would even get a response. But it was just like, why not? You know, I'm that kind of guy.
That's right. If you don't take the chance, it'll never happen.
The worst thing someone could say is no, right?
That's right.
And you'll never know if you don't take that chance.
That's how I do it here, guys. I'll tell you.
Yeah, man. And so I hit up the guy that's mixing, you know, Warren Haynes albums and Tedeschi Trucks albums. And
Marcus King.
Come to find out, way more albums than that over the years.
I mean, the names were unbelievable.
I didn't realize quite how big he was when I reached out to him. And I got an email back from that guy. I about fell out of my chair when I got that email back. And turns out Jim was from St. Louis originally. And so we had something in common, you know, both Missouri boys. And he said, man, he said, this was the Alive album. He said, you know, I've listened to what you guys got going on. And he's like, I really dig your sound and I really dig what's going on.
I think you got a good little band here, he said.
let's talk about this. And so I made a phone call and we got to talking. And long story short, the next thing I know,
we're flying to LA
on a plane to mix the album with the legendary Jim Scott.
Wow.
So that might have helped a little on the sound there.
You know, this is kind of, we're really telling a bit of a Cinderella story here. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking about a couple kids that you know, loved playing music. It never in a million years would have dreamed that some of these things would happen for us later down
the road. So Tell the World was also mixed by Jim Scott. That was the whole point of introducing that.
Okay.
We did have it mixed by him.
Yeah.
But, you know, Don could have done it. So,
sure. Oh, absolutely.
I think the next record, I'm just going to use my girls on the whole thing.
Well, I did have to take out a second mortgage on the house to have Jim mix those albums.
Not quite that bad.
And you know, but the thing was, is that I've always dabbled in recording since I was a kid. My dad had a 4-track recorder PA system when I was just a kid. I was recording songs, you know, 12, 13 years old. And getting to watch a master like Jim and getting to work with Jim, I mean, changed my life. I learned so much from him.
A lifetime friendship. I mean, we always text and we're like great friends. It's like we're family with him.
Yeah.
So it's cool. Really, I mean, the connections you make, like we were talking earlier about Memphis, it's just amazing. The people that you end up working with.
All right, guys, we got to go forward here. What's next for your band?
Writing the next record is what we're doing right now.
You're working on that now?
Yes. We've got a lot of songs waiting. I've gotten a lot approved already by Reba. So we're like 5 or 6 up. And then I've got 5 or 6 waiting to go to the boys. 5 or 6 others sitting there that ain't got no music to it. Because I just have to kind of write in intervals. Because I get as far as I can. And then I sing it into my phone. And then it has to go to the next person.
Yeah, makes sense. Sure.
So, yeah, we're waiting. We got 5 or 6 of them worked up pretty well. And the next batch is getting ready to be brought to the band and work on those. And, you know, I'm trying to, like we were talking about earlier about Montezuma Red, I'm trying to keep the woman theme going loud and strong on the next record because I feel like we need it really bad right now.
Well, you should. Sure. Yeah.
So, and that's kind of what my fans expect from me now. So I'm going big with that. I got 4 or 5 empowering women teaching, you know, like the young generation don't have a clue that they're, you know, their grandmas and moms couldn't even have a credit card until 1980.
Right.
You know what I mean? They don't know this. So I feel like it's my job to at least give props to our great grandmothers and mothers and what they fought for and what's being taken from us today. So I'm kind of, you know, trying to do it in a subtle way, but that's my message loud and clear pretty much is women, we've got to stick together and quit being separated like our whole country is right now. But, you know, women, especially if we would have stuck together, we wouldn't be where we are right now.
Right. All right, Kim, where can we send folks to learn more about your badass Mem Funk band? I assume they can get copies of your music there, maybe some merch, or maybe they can book you for a gig.
Yes. SisterLucilleBand.com, Sister Lucille on Facebook, Instagram is Sister Lucille, Kimberly Dill at Facebook, Jam and Jamie at Facebook.
Well, the cool thing about Sister Lucille name is that it's
Google
really,
us.
Really unique. The only competition we're really in is there was a gospel group from the 80s called Sister Lucille Pope. And then there's a comedian from Mississippi, a female comedian called Sister Lucille. Outside of that, if you Google Sister Lucille, especially Sister Lucille Band, there's like five or six Google pages of pretty much just us and a lot of stuff that, you know, just over the last 12, 13 years.
With great videos on YouTube, so you can check us out, see our live show.
Yeah, so we're real easy to find. But yeah, if you want to contact us, you know, SisterLucille.com, you can
do all the above.
Email us at SisterLucilleBand@gmail.com. We're real easy to get a hold of. We're easy to talk to, man. We just love taking our music and introducing it to new fans and new people. We're going to do a show with the Wichita Blues Society in Wichita, and that's going to be
October.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they reach out to us, and so you know. We're all about spreading the love and spreading the music, man. And, you know, quick shameless plug, actually two of my favorite songs.
Send you this record.
Nice.
We recorded in between the two albums, we recorded two singles and that's on red vinyl, as you see.
Oh, here. How
check
cool.
Out Gone.
And it's called Gone. And, I also recorded a song on there.
It's my favorite song I've written. So you have to check it out.
I also recorded a song on there called Grandpa's Song. And I spent most of 2023 taking care of my grandfather who had cancer. And so it kind of set us back a little bit with the band. Thank God the guy stuck with me and because it was a long year. And so
hell,
I wrote
what
that,
about COVID? That was bad too.
I wrote that song for my grandfather. And so that's one of my most proud songs actually is that single. It's called Grandpa's Song. So everybody go check out Grandpa's Song. It's from the heart.
Indeed.
I'll slip red vinyl in there for you when I send your CDs and sign
I'll
it.
Give it a good home, I promise. Well, Kimberly Dill, Jamie Holdren, all I can say to you both, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, is I'm excited to see what happens next for Sister Lucille. In the meantime, however, I wish you all Godspeed, safe travels. And thank you both for joining me today on Time Signatures.
Thank you for having
thank you,
us.
I appreciate you for having us. It really was an honor. You're so kind to us, man. Once again, I love the Blues family. Now you're part of the family for us, man. So
all right.
Maybe we can come see you at a festival or something.
Well, I want you to hang around till I get done here because I have something I need to read. But I want to tell you that now that you've been on this program, anytime you have an album or a tour to promote, you give me a call. We'll get you on and we'll do a promotional episode.
Awesome.
How's that sound?
Thank you.
That sounds great.
All right. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to Kim Dill and Jamie Holdren, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.